All right then, brethren, we're going to begin a new Bible study today, looking at the Old Testament book of Daniel, the book of the prophet Daniel. So, as we tend to do with Bible studies, we'll go through it chapter by chapter and verse by verse to get through all of it. And probably, if you've been with us the last year or so, we've referred quite often back to the book of Daniel in our sort of prophecy series, looking at Rome and Islam, and what prophecy has to say about the future. So the book of Daniel was very frequently called upon in those studies, particularly chapters 7, 8, 9, I guess 10, 11, and 12 as well, thinking about it. But we'll go through the entire book now and get, if you like, the entire prophecy in its full context. And I have been through it once before, but that turns out to be almost 10 years ago, so definitely due a revisit. And in many, many ways, the book of Daniel is a key book, particularly for prophecy. It's a key to understanding prophecy. It's fundamental, for example, to understanding the book of Revelation. There are so many references back to the book of Daniel over and over again. And as we go through the book, we'll get to certain passages which appear to be very specific prophecies that we can literally look out for, potentially due to be fulfilled in the next few years. Can't quite guarantee that, but fingers are pointing that way. So we'll dwell on some of those specific passages as we get to them. But before we open in Daniel, a wee bit of a background to the man himself. Some, what you might class as liberal Bible scholars, and there are such, don't even believe that there was a prophet called Daniel. You know, these are Bible scholars. Sometimes they are in various churches, but they have a very humanistic view of Scripture. And they believe that the book of Daniel was written by somebody or some bodies, all very anonymous, who wrote the book of Daniel hundreds of years after it was supposed to be set. You know, their problem is that when they look at it, they think, well, you know, if this was a real Daniel, he'd have lived around about 550, 600 BC. But the prophecies in Daniel go through the 500s, the 400s, the 300s, the 200s, and so on. Well, that can't be right. No human being could prophesy events that well in advance. So these must have been written after the events took place. Of course, that's only if you don't believe there's a God who gives prophecy. So the reality is that we can pretty much assure ourselves there was a Daniel, because a certain rather important individual named Jesus Christ referred to him. We're not going to turn there, but in Matthew 24, the Olivet Prophecy, Jesus starts talking about things to come, and Jesus, whom we all, I think, accept as our Lord and Master, says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then get running. That's a paraphrase, right? But so Jesus says, watch out for this incident, this big event, which was spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So Jesus believed in Daniel the prophet, and I guess so can we. And we'll leave the liberal scholars to their own devices. One other comment about Daniel before we start is that he was quite clearly an exceptional individual. Let's just open our Bibles briefly to Ezekiel chapter 14, where we see a reference to the man Daniel. Ezekiel 14, reading verses 12 and 13. So Ezekiel 14. And Ezekiel, by the way, was a contemporary of Daniel. They lived at the same time. Makes this even more of a, you know, intriguing remark. So verses 12 through 14. The word of the Lord came again to me, Ezekiel, saying, son of man, When a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread, send famine on it, and cut off man and beast from it. I'll deal harshly with such a country. Verse 14, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God. So three men singled out in God's eyes as particularly righteous individuals, perhaps the finest that God could think of, Noah, Job, but actually also Daniel, who was still alive at this time. Look at verses 19 and 20, same chapter. Or if I send a pestilence into that land and pour out my fury on it in blood and cut off from it man and beast, even though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, says the Lord God, they would deliver neither son nor daughter. They would deliver only themselves by their righteousness. So one thing we can say about Daniel, he's in some pretty good company. In God's eyes, he's one of the most righteous. And the guy's still alive, probably only in his 30s at this stage, a contemporary of Ezekiel. Okay, for a little bit of background before we open it, Daniel. The book of Daniel starts, you may as well turn to chapter 1, we'll be off in a moment. Daniel chapter 1, and obviously verse 1. So after Ezekiel comes Daniel. And the book opens with Nebuchadnezzar, who's the king of Babylon, laying siege to Jerusalem, circa 605 BC. 605 BC, about 2,500 years ago. Nebuchadnezzar is successful. He's a very powerful conqueror, and he takes a great deal of treasure away from the city of Jerusalem. He takes also quite a number of captives, among whom is Daniel. Daniel, it is thought, might well be of royal lineage, a very young man at this stage, probably aged around about 16 years old when he's taken captive. And he continued to serve in Babylon and later in the Persian Empire for the best part of 70 or so years. So he was still serving up into his 80s, perhaps 90s. So lived a jolly long time. Saw an awful lot of things happening. And God singles him out as a man who is extremely impressive. Very righteous individual. Okay. So here we are. Let's open in Daniel chapter 1 and begin in verse 1. We'll read through to verse 7, then come back and just unpack a little bit here and there. So Daniel 1:1 through to verse 7. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. This was about 605 BC. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the articles of the house of God, the temple, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men, in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking young guys, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And, you know, Daniel's among this lot. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies, and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. They got to be properly trained and prepared. Now, among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we normally call them, Verse 7, to them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, to Azariah Abednego or Abednego. Okay, so this is the beginning of Daniel's adventures, having been taken captive as a slave to Babylon, right? Now, some people have suggested that that Daniel and his three young buddies were made physical eunuchs when they were brought to Babylon, because it refers here to the chief of the eunuchs, and this was the view taken that, well, all these guys were made eunuchs. Well, possible, but not necessarily the case. It says up in verse 3, the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs. The New American Standard Bible translates that as the chief of his officials. Not eunuchs, but officials. So, and in fact, if you look at the way the word is translated elsewhere in Scripture, the word appears 42 times in the Old Testament. 13 times is translated as chamberlain, 12 times as officer, and the remainder as eunuch. It's the same term used of Potiphar. Now, you might remember Joseph back in the book of Genesis, how he was propositioned by a young woman. He wanted him to spend some time alone with her, and she was Potiphar's wife. So it's highly unlikely that Potiphar would be a eunuch if he has a wife. So the term does not necessarily mean a physical eunuch, although I would imagine that those officials who were in charge of the king's harem probably were, for fairly obvious reasons. So that's the story there of the eunuchs and who they were. So dropping back down to verse 7, we've got these. Daniel, his three friends, they're all given Babylonian names, which is probably part of starting to, some would say, brainwash them, change their identity. They're going to be taught the Babylonian language. They're going to be taught, the Chaldean literature. They're going to be taught the customs of the people of Babylon. They're going to eventually represent in front of the king and his courtiers. And they've got new names. So little by little, the idea is they're going to pretty much change their identities. Okay, let's look at verses 8 through 16. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs, chief of the officers, that he might not defile himself. Now, normally you might think this is something special. You've been brought captive. You've been treated fairly well, given an opportunity to serve in the king's court. And here, unlike perhaps people out in the fields and the farms, you're going to be sharing in the goodies that the king has, the king's delicacies, his fine stuff, whatever it was, and the king's wine. Pretty good, eh? But Daniel doesn't want to do that. He thinks he'll defile himself. Now, verse 9, now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, just a minute, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. It's his idea. If I don't give it to you, I'm in trouble. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age, by forfeiting all the king's goodies? And then you would endanger my head before the king. It might be okay, Daniel, for you not to eat this stuff, but if you end up looking all thin and pasty and worn, I'm going to get blamed for your state. Not very fair, Daniel. Verse 11, so Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Right? Let's hang back on all the king's chocolate and his apple pie and his glasses of the finest Burgundy and Beaujolais. Let's just have for us just some plain, simple fare. Verse 13, then let our countenances be examined before you, and the countenances of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, and as you see fit, so deal with us. Let's put it to the test. You know, one bunch eat the king's way, me and my three buddies eat a different way. At the end of 10 days, check us out. And then whatever makes sense to you, go with it. Verse 14, so he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward saw the light, and he took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables, plain fare from now on. So, they worked out quite well there, but you can see that probably Daniel's thinking, you know what, the stuff that's going to be served up here, a whole bunch of it is not going to be kosher, right? There's going to be boar, you know, pigs, and who knows what sort of creepy crawlies out of the ocean, and, you know, camels, and strange, unmentionable creatures. And even if it's not clean, or even if it is clean, it's probably going to have been served up in honor of some god or goddess anyway. So it'll be sort of spiritually tainted. So for one way or another, Daniel doesn't want to touch it. It's either going to be unclean, or it's going to come with a certain level of spiritual contamination, and Daniel's not, that's not the way I'm going. Now, it took some courage for Daniel. Don't forget, he was a captive. You know, he might have been well looked after, but he was a captive from a subjugated nation. He's got, you know, limited opportunities to present his case. And this was after all the king's food he was rejecting. So it took some courage when you're only maybe 16, 17 to say, excuse me, sir, I'd rather not eat the king's stuff. I don't think much of it. I'd rather have some, you know, bit of lettuce, bit of broccoli, you know, perhaps some Brussels sprouts,
which we've got,
a couple of glasses of water. probably bread as well, I imagine, in there as well. It's just vegetarian rather than eating what the king eats. But he was courteous, wasn't he? He said, you know, would you please do this for me? And you can see the guy's getting very agitated. Whoa, the king sees you looking all, you know, pukey at the end of this. It's my head that'll be in trouble. Okay, in that case, some wisdom. Let us put it to the test, Mr. Steward, for just 10 days, and then you can form your own conclusion. So Daniel's showing quite a bit of, you know, wisdom, common sense, you know, and courage. And he's quite courteous as well to the steward who sat over him. And when I read that, it always reminds me of an experience I had at the Feast of Tabernacles, my second Feast of Tabernacles, when I went to stay in a very small hotel in North Wales. In this hotel where I was staying for the feast, they had set meals. So you paid your money, and it included the, you know, the sort of breakfast and the evening meal and so on as part of the deal. But in the small hotel, the meals were actually fixed. So when you sat down in the table in the evening, the meal of the day came out. There were three courses, to be fair. It's quite decent hotel. But it came out, their choice of the day, and everybody got it. Now, before I went there, I wrote a letter and said, you know, dear sirs, I'm coming to keep a sort of church, a festival. One of the things that's a bit peculiar about me is I don't eat certain foods.
The only thing.
There were other things I didn't mention that were peculiar. But I did say, please note, I don't eat pork, black pudding. I don't eat, you know, nasty things from the bottom of the ocean. I hope that's okay with you. And anyway, got there, and of course, the very first evening I get there and sit down at the table, out comes roast pork with gravy and roast potatoes and carrots. Very traditional, Oh, no. Their first meal, roast pork. Oh, my word. What, you checked in 2 hours ago? I haven't developed a relationship yet with these people. Oh, this is awkward. So, oh, well, took a deep breath and got up from the plate, wandered down to the kitchens, knocked on the kitchen door. Excuse me. I said, I've got roast pork here. I'm not sure if you picked up on this, but I wrote a few weeks ago and said, I don't eat things like pork. And the lady said, oh, you're that man, are you? No problem, sir. We've got something else for you. So there was roast beef. So it was great. Went back to my table. 5 minutes later, out comes the roast beef with gravy, roast potatoes, carrots, all the stuff. Yeah, I'm very happy. A bit later, in comes another church member who sat at a separate table, young man, similar age to me. And I thought, oh, be interesting to see how he deals with the problem. So, of course, out they come with the roast pork, put it in front of him, and he ate it. Oh, hang on a second. That's roast pork. And he just scoffed a lot. I didn't challenge him on it, but I did sort of bring it into conversation, you know, a bit sort of later, talking about the hotel and how he's finding his bedroom and all the rest of it. I said, what about the evening meal? Oh, he says, I had to eat it. He says, I couldn't offend them. I just had to eat it. Well, you know, fair enough. But Daniel seemed to have no problem in potentially offending the steward, the chief of the eunuchs, and the king of Babylon, right? Different approach. Daniel, a very young man, quite courageous, quite wise. He's getting off to a pretty good start here, isn't he? Very impressive young man. Okay, let's move on and read verses 17 through 21. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. God can give, and God does give, exceptional abilities which come from God to a person. God gave these guys knowledge and skill in all literature. I guess they could read quickly. They learned the language very quickly. They picked up and remembered anecdotes, stories, histories, lessons, and they could put them to good use because of, in a sense, a supernatural gift. Verse 18, now at the end of the days, I guess that's sort of 3 years of training, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all, and there might have been scores more, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served the king. These were outstanding. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. And thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus, which was 70 years later. Right? A long time. So Daniel, exceptionally wise. His three buddies, exceptionally wise. And we might think, well, that's fantastic that God would give them wisdom that way and set them apart so they could serve in this brilliant manner in front of a king who's a very important king, as they were in those days, the power of life and death and so on. But actually, of course, God still gives wisdom. Let's look in a couple of places, so hold your place there. Stick your $50 bill in. And if we turn to James chapter 1, read verses 2 to 8. So it's great to have access to wisdom, but actually we do, in a way that the world, in theory, doesn't. So turn to Hebrews and then James chapter 1, reading verses 2 through 8. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. That sounds like a good place to be, to lack nothing, to have no want of anything, but apparently you only get there through trials. Anyway, moving on quickly, verses 5 through 8. If any of you lacks wisdom, okay, what if we lack wisdom? What if we're not as naturally gifted as Daniel was as a teenager? Well, we just read there that God gave wisdom and skill to Daniel and his three buddies. Here James says, if any of you lacks wisdom, don't just sit in a corner and mope. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God who gives to all liberally, generously, and without reproach, and it will be given to him. So if I lack wisdom, I should ask of God, and he'll grant it to me generously. If you lack wisdom, you're facing a trial, a tribulation, a test, a difficulty, an awkward decision in front of you, you're not sure what to do. Well, James says if we lack wisdom, particularly when we've fallen into various trials, we ask. And he says, God will give it to you. Verse 6, but let him ask in faith. Always a caveat. Let him ask in faith with no doubting. For he who doubts, will God give me wisdom? Or will he not? Well, I don't know, really. I mean, he might, but he might not. And at the end of the day, it says in Habakkuk chapter 7, you just never know what God's going to do you? Well, we do. It says in verse 5, ask and God will give it. But let him ask in faith, verse 6, with no doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways, double-minded, two minds. Yes, God will. No, he won't. Yes, he will. But then again, perhaps not. He could do, but maybe not me. Well, he did last time, but maybe not this time. That's double-minded. But if we ask for wisdom, James says, we should expect God to give us wisdom. So we'll be in the same position, in a sense, as Daniel. He was given great wisdom, and so can we. Look at 1 Corinthians 12, verses 4 through 8. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, another reference to wisdom being available from God. This is not just human wisdom. I guess we all meet in life people who've just got a great deal of natural wisdom. They seem to see, you know, the wiser, better decisions, and they seem to be able to make them and make progress that perhaps you and I just scratch our heads sometimes. There are people who've got good brains and are able to engage them in a way that just looks wise, and that's fine. But actually there's something we're talking about here which is extra wisdom from on high. So verse 4 through 8. Now, there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit, the Holy Spirit. There are differences of ministries, but the same Lord. There are diversities of activities, but it is the same God who works all in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. For to one person in the body, for to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit. So God will give a portion of wisdom necessary for the good of the body to a certain person. They'll be given the word of wisdom, a portion of wisdom by the Spirit. It's supernatural. Carrying on to another, the word of knowledge through the same Spirit. You know, somebody will just have a piece of knowledge that just arrives. They've not learned it. They've not found it in a book or, you know, Googling it. Just they know something they didn't know before, perhaps about a person, their experiences. They just know what that person did. I thought I'd come across that once years ago when I was early attending services, and I'd probably been attending only about maybe two services, and I was walking towards the front of the hall, and the minister was walking sort of towards me, and I had not really had much to do with him before this, and he sort of, you know, smiled at me, reached his hand out to shake my hand, and I reached my hand to shake his hand, and I just looked away. I thought, he can see right through me. He can see right through me. And,
he could.
You know, and Marge is saying he could as well. He had a sort of strange sort of power, but he just looked at you and you got the feeling, rightly or wrongly, he knows what I'm thinking. He knows what I'm up to. This guy, he's got X-ray vision. Now, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But that's sort of what's being referred to here. Somebody to whom God gives a piece of knowledge, a word of knowledge, a small message of knowledge that they did not get other than supernaturally. Then it carries on to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts, plural, of healings by the same Spirit, to another the working of miracles, and so on. So there are diversities of God's Spirit. There are spiritual gifts, which is being referred to here, that God can give. And one of them is God can and must occasionally give the gift of a word of wisdom necessary in due season for the body. So, you know, wisdom is still there, still available. Okay, let's go back to Daniel. That concludes, I think, chapter 1. So we've now got Daniel and his three buddies now in the court of the king, or serving at least towards the top of the administration. Picking up now in chapter 2, we come to quite an interesting chapter with significant, you know, prophetic importance. And now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. So he just sat up, bolt upright in bed. Wow! What was all that about? Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know or understand the dream. Because it really disturbed him. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, and actually this chapter and the next five chapters are all in Aramaic in the original, thankfully, been translated into English, otherwise we'd be struggling. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. Right? Just tell us what you dreamt. You know, did you dream you were sort of chasing a giraffe and you were eating a marshmallow and you were naked? And you tell us a dream, O king, and we'll tell you exactly what it means. We're good at that. But the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm, or the King James says, the thing's gone from me. Can't remember it in detail, guys. Or, my decision is firm, in the New King James Version, if you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you should be cut in pieces and your houses be made an ash heap or dunghill. Outhouse. Another translation. Because he's obviously just thinking to himself, hang on a moment, this dream's really disturbed me and I want to make sure I understand exactly what this was all about, because I think it's a special dream. Now, if these guys can't tell me what I dreamed, then how can I trust they'll tell me what it meant? So, okay, guys, verse 6, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain you would gain time, you sneaky lot. Because you see my decision is firm. You're trying to buy time, are you guys? If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream. You tell me what I dreamed. You tell me the content. And I shall know that you can give me, if you like, the true interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked anything of any magician, ever asked any such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. No one's ever asked that. It's impossible. How could anybody know what you dreamed? It's ridiculous. They wouldn't say ridiculous, of course. They'd be a bit wiser than that. Verse 11, it's a difficult thing the king requires, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling, of course, is elsewhere, not with flesh. For this reason, the king was angry and very furious, and he had a bit of a temper problem, and gave a command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, among whom they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. So the king's lost it. You know, he's got a dream. He knows it was a significant dream of some sort. And these characters, who are all living high off the hog, probably living off the hog in that sense, who are well paid, got fine quarters, looked upon as very important people with great status. They are the astrologers and the soothsayers and the sorcerers. They're living off the king's wealth. And he's saying, you can't tell me the dream? You won't tell me the dream? All right, off with your heads. And they start killing the wise men. So let's read verses 14 down to the end, down to 23. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard or bodyguard, probably the head executioner, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? Or the margin says, so harsh? What? Arioch? Noble Arioch? Why is the king having everybody executed? You know, what's this all about? Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house, made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's companions. You know, the king's ordered that we're all going to be put to death. And so Daniel obviously lets his buddies know. And then verse 18 says that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So let's go to God. Let's go to God in prayer and seek God's help. Seek an answer to this. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So there was a united prayer by these four guys, and God answered. You know, there is a time and a place for private prayer, which you and I, of course, should be accustomed to. And we can't dictate how long we should pray for, of course. There's no scripture that says any length of time, but certainly there are scriptures that say we should pray daily. Right? So we should all be praying every day. How long you pray for is really, I guess, up to you. And, you know, nobody else can dictate the length of time. The old Worldwide Church of God, etc., was 30 minutes a day. Some do that. Some do longer. Some may do shorter. I can't dictate what a good prayer time should be, but all of us should be people who pray sufficiently, right? So these guys are praying together. I've done that a small number of occasions, praying with other people. We used to do it in a sort of church conference we used to have about 15, 20 years ago. And we would fast the first day of our two-day conference, I think it was, one and a half to 2 days. And I think on the morning of the first day, we'd all get together, all fasting for the first day, and we'd all kneel down. And if there was maybe a dozen or 15 of us men, we'd pray. Good idea. The ladies prayed as well one of the times. Don't quite recollect that. And you can do that. You can go around and pray together. United prayer, all joined together for one particular purpose. I know the last time was pretty painful in the old knees because I think we're kneeling on a wooden floor for about an hour as about 15 or 20 or 25 people prayed, and the knees were giving up towards the end of that. Very painful experience. But here they are. These guys are praying to God, and they get an answer. Verse 19, then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom, you're right, wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings, becomes relevant to the dream. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. So, pretty good. Let's read verses 24 onwards. Therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. Now, probably too late for quite a few of the wise men. They already had bitten the dust, but still a number not yet been corralled and rounded up. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king. I would imagine, you know, Arioch doesn't particularly want to be slaughtering the astrologers and soothsayers and Chaldeans and so on, so he's probably, this is pretty good if there's a solution here, particularly if he can be attached to the solution. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I, Arioch, chief bodyguard, etc., or noble king, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I've seen and its interpretation? Can you do that? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals the secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. So he's going to reveal the dream first of all to the king. And he says, it's God, O noble king, telling you what will happen in the latter days. Verse 28 says, latter days. The New Revised Standard Version says, at the end of days. So that could be of interest to us because, although there's some relevance here to Nebuchadnezzar and a few others, essentially, in the main, this vision is about the latter days, the end of days, and that must be relevant to you and me. You know, later on in Daniel 12, Daniel's told to seal up the words of the prophecy until the time of the end. So though it's recorded by Daniel in, you know, 590, 580, 570, 560 BC and so on, in the main, a large portion of what's in this book is for the latter days, the end of the days, and therefore we're going to get something from it. Anyway, moving on to the actual sort of a dream. Verse 29, as for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. The NET translation says, while you were in your bed, your thoughts turned to future things. So apparently when he went to bed that night, Nebuchadnezzar was thinking, I wonder what will come after me. You know, I'm not going to be around for too many more decades, but what is going to happen in the future to my kingdom, and what's going to happen all the way down the road and around the corner? So he's wondering about the future, and lo and behold, gets an amazing dream. Verse 30, but as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image or statue. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you and its form was awesome. This was something really outstanding. And I guess as Daniel starts to recount, the memories come flooding back to Nebuchadnezzar. Yes, right. Yes, right. Verse 32, this image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, like dust. And the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. And that's going to be pretty impressive to Nebuchadnezzar, a dream which he had, which disturbed him, you know, strongly, which nobody could figure out. And here's this young man who says, this is what you dreamed, O king. Big statue, gold, silver, bronze, iron, big stone, smashes in the feet, you know, falls over, topples, smashes, gets blown away. Wow. And that's, of course, what Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed. But what does it mean? You can't just tell, can you? Just thinking, oh, what was that all about? But here comes, of course, the explanation at verse 37. You, O king, are a king of kings. Because Jesus is also king of kings and lord of lords. So I think Nebuchadnezzar was quite clearly, even in God's eyes, an outstanding individual. You are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength and glory, and wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. In at least the vicinity of the prophecy, obviously he wasn't ruler over China and Tibet and Australia, but over the sphere of the Middle East that is being caught up in the prophecy, Nebuchadnezzar is the boss. He's the king of kings, he's the lord of lords. And you are the set of gold. Verse 39, but after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours. I guess that's okay with Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, not surprised. I am, after all, the best. So fair enough, after me is coming another kingdom, not quite as good as mine. Yeah, I get that. Then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth, or at least all the earth as pictured in the prophecy. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom, notice, will break in pieces and crush all the others. Come back to that. This fourth kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Verse 41. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will not mingle with the seed of men. They will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron doesn't mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. So, astonishing. We've got the dream, we've got its interpretation, and we'll come back to in a moment as to what it means, but At this stage, Nebuchadnezzar is astonished and delighted. Look at verses 46 through 49. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel. I mean, this is, you know, exceptional. This is the king who was a mighty warrior, a mighty conqueror, a glorious king of kings, pictured by the head of gold, and he gets off his throne and he kneels down and puts his head on the floor in front of young Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. So, you know, God's brought about the elevation of Daniel from being just a, you know, a sort of a captive, albeit, you know, well looked after and with access to the royal court. But now he's climbing up the totem pole. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel, gave him many great gifts. He made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief wallah over the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel didn't forget his buddies. He petitioned the king and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate or the court of the king. So it's amazing that Daniel goes so quickly to being pretty much the head guy over a mighty empire like Babylon, and stayed in that position for, you know, decade after decade after decade, because he was able to reveal the meaning of this prophecy to the king. But what did the prophecy mean? The interpretation is there, and we've been through this before, so I'm not going to overly labour the point. Nobody's a big problem with the gold head, because after all, that is Babylon. Daniel tells us so. And after Babylon comes the silver kingdom, which is Medo-Persia. Nobody has a problem with that. After that comes the bronze, which is the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great and so on. Nobody's a problem with that. What about the fourth empire, the Iron One? That's where you've got at least two major options. One's extremely popular, which is that the fourth empire is Rome. Because, well, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, after Greece comes Rome. To Western European historians, yeah, it's the order. Babylon, yeah, Medo-Persia, yeah. Greece, yeah, after that, Rome, yeah. But is that what the prophecy is referring to? Is that the fourth empire of Daniel 2? Well, it was identified as Rome as far back as 200 AD. There's a Roman theologian, Hippolytus, H-I-P-P-O-L-Y-T-U-S, Hippolytus, who wrote a number of commentaries on various books of the Bible. He wrote a commentary on the book of Daniel, and he identified the fourth Iron Empire as Rome. Now, why wouldn't he? He looks around the world in his day and, yeah, Rome looks like a pretty powerful empire. I guess that's the one. And most people have followed suit for the last 1,800 years. You'll even get people like Hal Lindsey, you know, late great Planet Earth author. It's Rome, Western Europe. And so that leads probably the majority of Bible students today, I mean right today, to look to Western Europe, looking to Rome, to be this, the resurrected Holy Roman Empire, to Rome, to Western Europe, perhaps Germany leading 10 nations in Europe, perhaps somehow tied into the Vatican, and the Roman Catholic Church, right? That's a very, very popular idea, and that's, of course, one that probably all of us are familiar with, certainly the one I grew up with, but there's a problem or two or three or four or more. Verse 40. And the fourth kingdom, this iron kingdom, shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things, like iron that crushes that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. So this fourth kingdom must break in pieces and crush. Now, the word break in pieces is a Hebrew word. Well, actually, an Aramaic word, thinking about it. Dekak, and that would be D-E-Q-A-Q, Dekak, which means to crush, to pulverize, to shatter. Break in pieces, in other words. You can imagine, you know, if you're working in a, you know, as a perhaps in prison years ago, they might give you an interesting job like breaking up rocks. You know, a big sledgehammer and spend all day, you know, crushing and pulverizing rocks. You know what it means to pulverize a rock, to crush a rock, to shatter a rock. You smash it into little pieces, so just fragments and dust. Well, here's the problem. Rome never conquered Persia, ever. So the scripture says the fourth empire will crush, pulverize, shatter all the others. Rome never conquered Persia. Tried for hundreds of years. Never succeeded. And what about Rome? Did it crush Greece? Well, Rome defeated the Greek armies. But, you know, Rome wasn't basically about crushing other nations. All they looked for basically was give your allegiance to our emperor and pay your taxes. That was it. That was how Rome flourished. Well, they left nations to have good economies. Make sure you pay your taxes. Make sure you give your loyalty to our emperor, and then fine. When it came to Greece, Rome actually rather admired Greek culture. Greek architecture, they imported it. Greek plays, they imported them. Greek literature, yeah, we'll have that as well. Greek religion, gods and goddesses, well, we'll rename them, but we'll have them. And what about even the Greek language? Did that get stamped out? No. Take our New Testament, written in Greek. Not Latin, not the Roman language, because Greek was still the language of the world. So, really, if you think about it, Rome never conquered Persia at all, and it never pulverized and smashed Greece. So, really, on biblical evidence, Rome just doesn't fit very well. Now, what we said before was there is one empire which does, and that's Islam. The Islamic Empire absolutely fits this description. You know, starting in the 600s AD, Islam swept across all of North Africa, or across the entire Middle East, right over towards India and into India. It conquered Persia, which Rome never did. It conquered Persia in about 20-odd years, even though Rome had fought for hundreds of years. And, of course, Islam conquered Turkey, Greece, right up into Spain and parts of France. At one point, it was right up to the gates of Vienna in Austria. And Islam, the Islamic empires, did crush and pulverize. They wiped out religion, culture, government, education. Even the alphabet was changed in many countries. And come 1453, Islam conquered Constantinople, which was the capital of the time of the Roman Empire. Clean sweep. They got it all. Now that's Dekak. That's smashing, pulverizing. And some people estimate, and it is a, I guess, pretty rough estimate, that Islamic Jihad in the last 1400 years since it surfaced has killed approximately 270 million people. And I suspect more to come. So looking at this fourth empire, which, notice, gets destroyed by the returning Jesus Christ. It's the stone cut out without hands that smashes the statue. So this will go right up to Jesus' return, his parousia, as we were looking at sort of, you know, lately. And we're talking here about, notice, real empires. Babylon's a real empire. Medo-Persia, a real empire. Greece, a real empire. and either Rome or Islam, real empires, to be replaced by God's empire, God's kingdom. It's real. It's on the earth. Real people in it. It's a real empire. It's not some imaginary, nebulous thing in people's hearts. The kingdom of God is as real as the kingdom of Babylon and the kingdom of Medo-Persia and so on. There's one little curiosity here which does not prove anything. So let me repeat that. This little curiosity proves nothing. It's just a curiosity, but I'll mention it in passing. In verse 43, it says here, "As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men," but obviously won't stick to each other. The NET translation says, "So people will be mixed with one another." So one says mingle, the NET says will be mixed, so people will be mixed with one another. Well, the original language at that point has the word Arab, A-R-A-B, Arab. So you could, if you didn't translate that word, it would be, "So the people will be Arab." Okay, I've proved nothing at all. One of those perhaps interesting coincidences that if you just left it as it was, you would simply at that verse say, "The people will be Arab." Islam, of course, has its birthplace in Arabia and is ultimately an Arabian religion, but perhaps it means nothing. Just an interesting curiosity. So for us today, we've got at least these two options. We can watch Europe and Rome and the Vatican. What I've said is that I would not exclusively watch that area because I think it's got real difficulties scripturally. And I suggest that either in addition or perhaps even with greater priority that you and I should watch Islam. And when we get to chapter 8, we'll see that Iran and Turkey do seem to feature significantly there. Okay, let's move on now to chapter 3. "Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon." Not too clear how many years after chapter 2 this is. Very shortly, perhaps he had an image in his mind at the time, or perhaps a decade or two had elapsed. That's just not clear. But anyway, he builds this massive statue, or possibly it's an obelisk, some people think, and 90 feet high. It's been 9 stories high, pretty decent-sized obelisk, and a 9-foot across. Odd dimensions if it's a human. That's not 10 to 1, is not sort of the ratio of people like you and me, more like sort of 5 or 6 to 1, not 10 to 1. But anyway, this big thing goes up there, this big image. "And the king Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image, which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." Could be a pretty big day. "So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces, so all around the empire, gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, 'To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, plural, and languages, plural, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace.' So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of this big orchestra, they fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." This is obviously a major event. You know, people invited, commanded to come from everywhere to this super big day. So there's probably thousands and thousands of these, nobles. And there's a huge orchestra made up of all sorts of instruments, although I can't see the bagpipes there. or accordions, but other instruments are there in large numbers. And when the music starts, you get down and bow your head and you worship this image. Now, some people see here a possible shadow of the Antichrist and the image of the beast, which people will be commanded to worship. I think you certainly see something there. God, not turning there, but in Revelation 13, John talks about how they make an image to the beast, and people are commanded to not only take the mark of the beast, they're also told to worship the image of the beast, and if they don't, they will die. And chapter 20 of Revelation talks about people being beheaded because they stuck with the word of God. So it's quite possible there's a little bit of a play here as a theme, Nebuchadnezzar being, the Antichrist, this obelisk or image being the image of the beast, and the people who don't worship are going to be killed. Certainly plausible. Verse 8, therefore at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and all that lot shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. Right? Well, there are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. So they're being shopped, aren't they? Now, the Chaldeans, these are the surviving Chaldeans, of course. Some had lost their heads a bit earlier, the last time that Nebuchadnezzar got angry. And I guess some of them were quite jealous of the way that Daniel and his three buddies have got very senior positions out of this. And so, being jealous, they're seeking to get their own back, but a vengeance. They don't mention Daniel here. Perhaps they thought he was a bit beyond criticism, but his three buddies certainly aren't. And so, Nebuchadnezzar, these three guys, what about them? Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, because he did have a temper problem, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Because he wouldn't necessarily want to trust his Chaldeans. He knows about court envy or court jealousy and people that make up stories and defame others. So he's got a bit of wisdom himself there. Is it true? Is this a fact, guys, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I've set up? Is that true? Now, if you are ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, orchestra, you fall down and worship the image which I've made, good. So when the music starts, you get on your knees, we're fine. But if you do not worship, let me remind you, you should be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands, guys, eh? You won't worship my gods? Do you think yours can protect you? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. So there.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Yeah.
But if not, you have to, there's two ways of interpreting this next verse, come back to in a moment. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Right? Ooh. So here's Nebuchadnezzar. He's given these guys, if you like, a second chance. They didn't bow down at the first time the orchestra played, but he says, now if you do it this time, we're okay with each other. And you know, and they say to him, well, if you throw us into the burning fiery furnace, our God will deliver us. But if not, then people think, does that mean if God doesn't deliver them? Obviously, they'll burn up. So if God doesn't deliver us, we won't serve your gods. We'll obviously be burnt or crisp. That becomes a bit of an irrelevance. Another view is that if you throw us into the lake of fire, not lake of fire, something else. If you throw us into the burning fiery furnace, our God will deliver us. If you don't throw us in, in other words, if you decide not to, let it be known we still wouldn't serve your stupid God. Verse 18, but if not, if you don't throw us in, let it be known to you, O king, we still wouldn't serve your gods, and we'll never worship that big obelisk you set up. So whether you throw us in or whether you don't throw us in, forget it. And that appears to be more likely, because it really turns Nebuchadnezzar into a white-hot rage. Verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. He'd given these guys a way out. And they tell him, doesn't matter what you do, mate. Throw us in, don't throw us in. Makes no difference. You can stuff your obelisk. In the vernacular. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression of his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. Yeah, get more coal in there. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning, fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning, fiery furnace. Now, the shape of the furnace appears to be something like a big dome, you know, probably built of hardened bricks. So it would be a big dome with perhaps a ramp leading up to the top, perhaps an earthen ramp that you would walk up the ramp to the top of the dome. Top of the dome's an opening where they put things in, like in this case, these three guys. And then perhaps down at ground level, there's probably a door or another opening at the side where you would normally, you know, sort of bring out ashes and things. You're going to clean the furnace. So something like that. So these strong men of valor, these important men in the army, they tie up these three guys, and they walk up this ramp towards the top. Verse 22, therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Wow. So I guess the flames just burst out the top of this thing, perhaps unexpectedly, and it just toasts the army men. Don't know how many's there, half a dozen perhaps. Gone. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning, fiery furnace. Because if you're on the roof of this dome where perhaps the big hole is, and you've been released by these other guys, you just tumble down. Probably break your neck. And be toasted as well. But of course that doesn't happen. So they fall into this burning, fiery furnace. And verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. He rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? And they answered and said to the king, true, O king. But of course, if he said, did we not throw a polar bear and 2 talking donkeys into the furnace? Oh, true, O king. Whatever you say, O king. Yeah, amen, O king. He said, well, look, I see 4 men loose walking in the midst of the fire. And they're not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like, it says like the son of God, but I think it's like a son of God. Nebuchadnezzar would know nothing about the God of heaven and his prophesied son, but like a son of the Elohim. Wow! And so he's astonished. These guys, well, his army guys are now ash up in the ramp somewhere, and these three Jewish guys are walking about in these roaring flames, and there's a fourth person in there as well who looks like a sort of divine being of some sort. Verse 26, then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. No smell of smoke. Nothing. This is impossible, isn't it? This is impossible. It's impossible. But then God does the impossible. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel, you know, some divine being, and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word, my word, and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, or an outhouse, I think is the proper rendition, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Now this doesn't mean at any stage that Nebuchadnezzar becomes converted to the God of the Jews. He simply acknowledges that the God of the Jewish nation is pretty powerful and appears to be a lot more powerful than other gods, including his own. But of course, he's still loyal to his own gods, to Baal and Marduk and others. But he does recognize that this Jehovah God of the Jewish people is pretty outstanding. And one thing he doesn't want any people doing is blaspheming this very powerful God of the Jews. Hence the decree says, don't. I would imagine, in a sense, one of the spin-offs would be that the Jews themselves might be a bit more cautious about referring to their God, since the king has said anybody who badmouths their God, the Jewish God, will be in severe trouble. And of course the Jews were in captivity because they weren't very good at being faithful to their God. So that's part of the story of these three guys, a tremendous example of individuals who would not compromise, right? Even though they faced apparently a certain death, they would not compromise their faith in their God. And I guess the end of this age, there's going to be many opportunities for people to compromise, to take the mark of the beast, to worship the beast and his image. And some people are going to fall. They're not going to follow the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But we'll pick that part up perhaps a bit next week before we move on. So with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.